Welcome to Against the Grain, a podcast that investigates unconventional ideas in science and medicine. My name is Dr. Samir Kakodkar. I am a gastroenterologist and a specialist in ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. Today, I speak to a patient with ulcerative colitis, possibly Crohn's colitis, who I advised over the last 3 years along with his treating gastroenterologists. He wanted to do everything he could to avoid surgery and was really willing to try some things that were outside the box, including fecal transplantation, a medication called Xeljanz prior to FDA approval, the specific carbohydrate diet, and even hyperbaric oxygen therapy. This is part one of our conversation. So take go to the beginning. Like what?
Okay.
Were you diagnosed, and what symptoms did you have, and what happened in the beginning?
Okay. So I was always like a normal one poop a day, favorite part of my day, coffee and poop in the morning, you know, well-formed guy. Like, I mean, you know, my whole life. That was, and then in about like April, May of, 2015, I started noticing some more urgency. Like as soon as I would smell my coffee, I would have to like kind of go to the bath, like rush. And I was just like, well, you know, that's maybe whatever. And then more and more. And then I was going, you know, two or three times a day. I'd have a coffee at lunch and I would start going. All of a sudden, I kind of noticed a little bit of blood, very little, like when I wiped. And I had been going more. So I thought for sure I had hemorrhoids. I was hopeful I had hemorrhoids. That same year, or maybe 6 months prior, my mother had been diagnosed with celiac disease. So I kind of was thinking maybe I had something like that going on because my stools were getting looser as well. And I was thinking that was like the worst thing ever, by the way, like celiac disease. If I had that now, you know, I would buy that with all the money I had if it was an option. But right. so I did that, and I kind of messed around with it for like a month or two. And then I got to the point where I was noticing kind of more persistent blood. So I was like, well, even if these are hemorrhoids, I got to do something. So I went to the University of Chicago. I looked up actually the person who was kind of more involved with celiac disease, because I was thinking and hopeful in light of my mother and just, again, more hopeful that that was my issue. So I went there. I gave her my symptoms and whatnot. Actually, she did a flex sig that day, which was interesting. You know, that we were able to get it approved and everything. And then she was pretty convinced I had ulcerative colitis.
So that was unsedated. She just did it in the clinic.
Yeah, unsedated.
How was that? That probably wasn't too comfortable.
It's funny. I've had almost all of my flex sigs and one colonoscopy unsedated. Because I always wanted to be able to go to work after.
Yeah.
So, for the listeners, I'm a physician, so you know, I wasn't really able to take that much time off. And so I did all those unsedated. They're really not that bad. A little uncomfortable in the beginning, and you can feel like the biopsy, you can feel like a pulling sensation from the inside out. It's a little bit of an odd sensation, but it doesn't hurt. So anyway, she told me I had ulcerative colitis. That was May. I actually got that diagnosis in May or early June of 2015. I was finishing my residency then, my head and neck surgery ENT residency, and I was moving to California in like 2 weeks.
So how did it feel to get that diagnosis when you first heard it? What was running through your mind?
Yeah, it really was not on my radar, which in hindsight as a physician, I mean, it was stupid to not have that on my radar, but I was like shocked. It was such a blow to my self-esteem, my everything. And I remember she was like, well, it's not, you know, at least it's curable. It's not that big. Like she totally was downplaying it. But man, I was like, it was a big hit for me.
That is one thing that you know, the standard kind of thing they teach you when you do like a GI fellowship and counseling patients with IBD is, yeah, they tend to downplay it once you're diagnosed with it. And they say, oh, you're going to live a normal life. There'll be some bumps in the road that we'll take care of. But, you know, we're going to try to make you feel well most of the time. You're going to be able to do whatever you want. which sometimes that may not be the case for some people. And I think it is a little bit disingenuous. Like, everybody is different. And some people don't have a smooth transition to, you know, managing this disease.
Yeah, I think maybe she could appreciate how hard I was taking it. Mm-hmm. So she was trying to help me, but she definitely, I wasn't happy with the way she kind of delivered it and helped me kind of accept the diagnosis.
Right.
But so that happened. She gave me Lialda, which was new at that time. That was like 4 pills a day, or maybe even 8 pills a day. I don't remember the dosage. And that like cured me. The next day I had normal stools. I felt great. It was awesome. I was like rocking and rolling. That was June, like mid-June. By mid-June, I felt pretty good. I had my first daughter July 2nd, which was like 2 weeks later from me feeling good. One month after the formal diagnosis, probably like 6 months after I, you know, got the disease. Kind of, it's such an indolent onset. So I had my daughter July 2nd, and I remember in the hospital, we had a very stressful birth. She was like, they tried to divert her because she was breech, and then my wife had a big bleed. It also was my first day of fellowship that we had my daughter. Mm-hmm. So the point is, I had a lot of stress then, and I had noticed bleeding in the hospital that that evening or whatever while we were in the hospital with my daughter.
So for you, do you think that stress was a contributor to the onset of the disease or subsequent worsening? Have you noticed a correlation between stress?
It definitely is correlated. Not to jump ahead too far, but this most recent flare I'm in, my mother got diagnosed with colon cancer. I had to go home and meet the surgeon, and she had a colectomy or a hemicolectomy. So I had a flare like pretty much right with that. So it definitely is associated. I also, you know, was down on my steroids at this time. So it's hard to say, like, complete cause and effect. You know, I really don't get stressed. My wife always says, like, I don't understand if you just keep all your stress in your colon or something, man. I don't look stressed. Mm-hmm. I don't really like feel stress. It's just like when you step back and look at it, that's a stressful time.
Right.
I mean, I do feel stress, but it's not like it inhibits my day or, you know what I mean?
Right.
So it's a little bit odd. And I've been trying to meet with somebody to see if there's a way, like cognitive behavioral therapy or something, but nobody really has an answer. You know,
yeah.
I've read a couple books, I've done a couple things, and there's, you know, I don't know. I mean, I feel like I deal with my stress fine. Again, being a physician, you've gone through stressful times. So it's not like it's new to me, but.
And the steroids definitely don't help. They're amplifying the stress, the anxiety.
I remember you. I have been talking to Samir, Dr. Kokodiker, throughout this whole process. And because, you know, I went to school, I went to residency with his brother. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you had always been stressing the steroids. So after I got on the Lialda, I got kind of bad. So they gave me a dose of steroids, and that again made me better. And really the steroids for me made me like manic, not in a scary way, but in a way like, I mean, I was like a machine. I was getting so much work done. I was doing research. I was like, I mean, people probably thought I was on cocaine. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, so I wasn't getting the bad side effects in the beginning. Now I'm starting to, I guess I wasn't appreciating the bad side effects. I mean, I think I was a little more snippy. My wife would call me a prick from time to time, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of stuff. I had that and I didn't sleep well. So those were my biggest issues with the steroids. But now I've been on them again because all the medications have failed. So I've been on high dose for a while now, and it's really taken a toll on me.
Mm-hmm.
But so back to July. So it was July of 2015. I just moved to California. We had a baby like 3 days after we moved. It was crazy. It was my first day of fellowship. With the steroids, I got okay. I went and saw someone who tried to get me to. She wanted me to do Remicade and Imuran, and I like was, you know, really hesitant and saying, man, you know, the risks of that combination and lymphoma and infection versus, you know, steroids for a few months. Like, shit, I mean, I'm just going to do the steroids and see, you know, if I can try a diet or whatever. So I talked my way out of that.
Mm-hmm.
I did feel okay while I was on the steroids. GI wise, other than kind of the side effects of the steroids. So that gets me to like middle of August, September. And then I start getting bad again as I taper them. So I go see her again and we discuss other options. I think I try all the other ASAs, but I start to have like a reaction to those. When I took Asacol, I got like deathly ill, like immediately the day I took it. And then I tried to take it for like 3 days. And then when I stopped it, I got better. So they determined I have like a sensitivity to those.
An allergy, right.
Yeah, and essentially. And so I went through all of those. Because you can not have the allergy to one and have the allergy to others. And, mm-hmm. Then I pretty much talked her into letting me try Humira, essentially so I could, you know, give it to myself and not have to get infusions. Because again, I'm in my fellowship, you know, like I can't be asking to have, you know, half a day off every 4 to 8 weeks for infusions. So I did Humira. That didn't really do much for, you know, I did the 12 weeks of whatever the dosage is every 8 weeks. And then we did double dose. That didn't really work.
Didn't get any response to it? Like after you started it, you didn't notice much?
I don't think so. I would try to act like I did, but I kept a pretty good calendar on my phone, or a journal kind of thing, like where I put the date and how I felt and, mm-hmm. I don't think it was significant. I mean, to be honest, for 3 years, I haven't been well. Mm-hmm. You know, I have good days, but never a good month, you know.
And you were on steroids while on Humira, right? And there were attempts to taper you, and it just didn't work out.
Right? I would get off them for a month. I got off them, I think, and then I got off them another month, maybe last year. But then I just, you know, slowly get worse and worse and worse and worse until I'm horrible. Okay. So, like, again, as a physician, it seems idiotic that I would let it happen, but I totally did multiple times. So then after that, I think I had a colonoscopy at the end of, was I in Entyvio in California? Well, I don't know. I had a colonoscopy at the end of 2016. That was horrible. Like severe inflammation, you know, the guy was like, this is not good. You know, you need to figure something out. But I was moving back to Chicago to kind of start a job here. Mm-hmm. So then I got into somebody here to start, you know, getting care here. We did start Entyvio. Again, they wanted me to do Remicade and Imuran, but I talked them out of it. Which, honestly, in hindsight, I truthfully... I mean, I don't know, but I feel like if I had done Remicade and Imuran from the very beginning when she tried to get me to, that would have been my best chance to get well. Right. Not saying that I wouldn't still be sick now. I mean, I might have only gotten well for 6 months, mm-hmm. but that's a mistake I think I made. But you never know. I mean, so I got on Entyvio. We did that for, 12 weeks. I think I even did a double dose of Entyvio a few times. Mm-hmm. That didn't. And Entyvio, again, you ask if I get better, you know, maybe a couple days, like the day or two after, I feel like I'm a little bit better. But, you know, they give you a liter of fluids at the time. I mean, nothing significant. I'm not like, you know, jumping up and down because I'm cured kind of thing.
Sure.
So it didn't correlate. You know, I didn't improve, I would say. Then finally, after the Entyvio, and I'm about the same through this. I'm going like anywhere from 3 to 10 times a day. I have pretty bad kind of cramping pains. I remember in California, I cut all of my underwear bands because I couldn't stand the pressure on my lower abdomen just from my underwear, you know. So I couldn't wear a seatbelt in the car because that put too much pressure on my abdomen. So when I look back, like I was pretty sick.
Yeah.
You know, when you really look back at it, like, I went to the ER once. I honestly thought I like perfed my bowel. It was that much pain. Wow. And I was scared. Like I made my wife take me to the ER. I was like, fuck. And it was just, I don't know what it was. Maybe just a little backup. I got some fluid. They tried to admit me. I wouldn't let them. Mm-hmm. I got a bunch of fluid, some morphine. And then they gave me like, that was when I had let my steroids get way down again. So then they bumped me back up to 60 milligrams, and then I went on my taper again. So it's, I mean, I was like classic. It's like a complete sinusoidal wave, my course. Mm-hmm. In Chicago, I ended up doing Remicade. Again, 12 weeks, then the double dose. Not really feeling any better. You know, maybe a little bit the day after, but nothing significant. Mm-hmm. Then I started getting kind of scared, you know, like, shit. I mean, throughout this whole process, I never thought I would be somebody to have surgery. I mean, I would have bet all of the money I have that I would not have surgery.
Yeah.
Or at least not until I got to like the 10-year mark and they were telling me, you know, you have histologic changes concerning for precancer, or, you know, something like that. Mm-hmm. So I after the Remicade, I'm kind of like, you know, getting pretty nervous now because I've kind of run through my options. I mean, there's all these new ones. Stelara, and then Xeljanz was out. So I was really interested in Xeljanz. Obviously, it's PO. It seemed to have fairly good results comparatively to all these meds, which, as you know, Samir and everybody else, I mean, still the results are shitty. You're talking 20%, you know,
right,
of a population, so not of the worst. And I was kind of in the worst class, so I'm figuring, but whatever. So we fight with the insurance company. They end up giving me clearance. At the same time, I had met with a surgeon, and I had researched a little bit hyperbaric oxygen. Samir and I had talked about it. And, you know, I have enough money, so I found a place and, you know, a guy, a really nice guy. It's called Lakeshore Hyperbaric. I would highly recommend him. He worked with me really well for my schedule. And I did 20 dives an hour and a half at 2.5 ATMs. That, I would say, made me feel better, no doubt. Like, I would get it at 4 p.m., so by 5, then at 5:30, I'd be out of the tank, and you feel like you could run a marathon, probably because you're, like, hyperoxygenated, or it is because you're hyperoxygenated.
But for that you felt your colitis symptoms improved, or just overall your energy level?
I think it's probably more, this was, like, 2 months ago. We're up to, like, today now. Uh-huh. Just because all of these meds took like 3 months to try. There wasn't anything eventful, you know, other than feeling shitty for 3 years. So the hyperbaric, I'm so deconditioned right now. My albumin was 2, my hemoglobin's 8. You know, I think it was more like my overall just well-being, like just, I don't know, I'm so weak. You know, I walk up the stairs and I have to take a break. Mm-hmm. And I'm just sitting there. I mean, I used to be a guy who runs marathons. I used to work out 6 days a week. Like, I just shake my head when I think about what's happened to me. Mm-hmm. So I think it's more that. You know, to be honest, like, this last flare, my colitis, like, I don't really have too much pain. It's just going. I go 7-8 times a day. I go all night. Every 2 hours, like clockwork, all night. I don't sleep. And then I'm just, you know, nutritionally so depleted that, you know, I got down to 135 pounds. My base, like my healthy weight when I'm feeling good and working out, I'm like 180 pounds. Wow. And I lost that in like 2 months with this last flare. So now I weigh like 145, 148 pounds. So I've gained about 10 back.
So you weighed 180 pre-diagnosis?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Wow. And I got back to like 170, 175 a few times. Mm-hmm. Probably when I was on the high dose steroids.
Right.
And then this most recent flare, we did also try IV steroids. Again, they tried to admit me. I didn't let them. So I went in as an outpatient and got IV steroids for 3 days in a row. I went and got IV fluids a few times throughout this mess just because being a physician, I had access and like days I wouldn't eat for like 3 days. So I'd have to just go get, not because I couldn't, it's just I had no appetite at all. So I would go get like 2 liters of fluid just so I could work. Because fellowship, you really can't mess around. And I was kind of, well, I wasn't kind of. Nobody really knows, you know, my none of my family and friends really knew. So I was just kind of hiding it. Mm-hmm. So now I've done the 20 dives of hyperbaric. I've done Zeljans now for a month at the 10 milligrams BID dose, which is the studied dose. I'm really not any better. I look better and I feel better. Again, kind of more overall. And that's because I gained like my 10 pounds back, but still 145 pounds. I mean, I'm still 40 or 35 pounds lighter than I am when I'm well. I mean, people who see me who haven't seen me in 6 months or a year are like, are you dying? I mean, yeah. I have nurses in the hospital who I don't even know.
Right. And you have been monitoring your CRP through the hyperbaric oxygen and with the Zeljans, and that really hasn't budged, right?
Well, it did drop. You know, I don't know who's listening to this, but, you know, a normal CRP is like 0 to 8. Mm-hmm. I looked up, actually, when I first got diagnosed, my CRP was 5. So that this is just for reference. Okay. And then this flare, it was 205.
Yeah.
Which is like, you know, like I don't know where the record book is on CRP, but it's up there. So I'm on 30 milligrams of steroid, 10 milligrams of Zeljans BID, and my last CRP was 92.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still, you know, outrageously high, but it is half of what it was when I was feeling the worst. So, and me, it does seem to correlate to kind of my disease. Some people, I guess it doesn't, but. Mm-hmm. I had a flex sig 3 months ago or something, and right around when I had that real high CRP, and it was horrible.
Mm-hmm.
But now, I mean, I'm bleeding still because my hemoglobin's still dropping, so that's pretty shitty. And you know, that's the most concerning part. And now, you know, unfortunately, I've met with three surgeons.
Mm-hmm.
And I have it set up, actually, to have surgery in a week.
And what, you know, I know there was, you were considering possibly doing cyclosporin as a transition to azathioprine. And if you can just go over kind of the rationale. It was an interesting, I know you had an appointment at University of Chicago where you got a completely different opinion about your diagnosis and management.
That was a big twist. So I have these, like, skin tags or... They're like ulcerated skin tags. And I think I've had them for a long time. The University of Chicago team feels that I have Crohn's colitis fairly confidently. And then my other physician at Rush feels still that it's ulcerative colitis. It's a little bit of a moot point because the treatments are at this stage when you've tried everything are the same, experimental or surgery. But yeah, so that was kind of a big twist. The cyclosporin we talked about, as you just mentioned, and then transitioned to, another PO medication thereafter. And I don't know. I just did the research and the data and just the chances of me being well 2 years from now and off of medications is, almost zero. So I have 2 young kids. My wife's pregnant. You know, at this point, I'm just so exhausted. I just got to get well. And everybody's kind of, but when I explain my thought process there, everybody's kind of like, then I think you are ready for surgery. And the chances of me having surgery are, even if I respond to cyclosporin and do well and, you know, 6 months I'm in remission, you know, in 2 years, the chances are 3 years needing surgery is still extremely high.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
And then there's that unknown of just like when. When is it going to just tackle me again?
And just to briefly go over some of the details there. So the skin tags, we usually don't see large ulcerated skin tags in ulcerative colitis. So that's why they were thinking it was more Crohn's. Mm-hmm. And the rationale for why cyclosporin may work better than these other more protein-based biologic drugs.
The albumin, yeah.
Because your albumin was low, and you're just leaking these drugs into your bowel because it's going along with the bleeding and the blood that's in your bowel, and you have these ulcerations.
They did a good job explaining that maybe all of these biologics had a chance, but in me, I was so kind of severe, ulcerated and draining and weeping all of these medications that none of them had the opportunity to work in me.
And cyclosporin is not protein-based. It gets more into the tissues, so it possibly would have had an effect. But
So then my logic there was, Well, neither does, you know, Zeljans is not protein based.
Right.
So I thought, you know, then that should help me, right? Or if it's good, again, it's a different mechanism.
Different mechanism.
Cyclosporin's a little more broad, but, you know, so I felt like I gave that a chance, you know.
Sure.
So that was my kind of compromise to not doing cyclosporin.
Now, I think your decision to go for surgery is completely reasonable at this point. And even as we talked before, even probably a couple steps before, you know, doing the hyperbaric oxygen, the Zeljans, most gastroenterologists would say, you know, go ahead.
Yeah.
You've suffered enough with this.
Yeah, they were telling me that. And I mean, the hyperbaric cost me, I don't know, $9,000 or $10,000.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's not like that wasn't just like, oh, let's just go sit in a hyperbaric machine for a couple of days.
Right.
You know, so it was relaxing. I look at it as like a little bit of a therapy, but, again,
another thing you tried, and we are going to have a lot of listeners who are listening.
Oh yeah.
Who are part of the specific carbohydrate diet community.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I know what they're thinking, cause they've heard your story and they're probably thinking, oh, why didn't he try diet? If he tried diet, he wouldn't be surgery right now. So tell them what your experience was with.
So SME. that was lost in the 3 years. I kind of fast forwarded. Well, I definitely tried a gluten-free diet, like very strict. My wife, my mother's celiac, and like a bunch of my wife's family's celiac disease. So we know how to do a real gluten-free diet, you know, like don't use the same toaster. And I mean, I did it for real for like probably 3 months. They genetically tested me and biopsied me. I knew I wasn't celiac, but I wanted to try that. So I started with that just because that was something easy. That didn't touch me. Then actually it was right after I met Samir, right after we kind of started talking about this, he mentioned his diet and recommended a book. And, you know, I mean, I told him, shit, I would eat grass every day if it would make me healthy. Mm-hmm. So we did it. I mean, I went like full steam. I did it for 6 months. I made all my food at home. I was, you know, I mean, I was making the brownies. I still make the brownies because it's good calories. Mm-hmm. But I did the specific carbohydrate diet by the tea. My wife was obsessed with it. She was cooking everything. I mean, we kind of did it as a family almost. They would cheat, but, I kind of thought it was helping, a little bit. But then I go back and the sinusoidal wave of, and when I say helping, meaning like I would get to going 3 or 4 times a day would be my like best.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was totally correlating with my steroids. So it happened, you know, obviously I started the specific carbohydrate diet when I was feeling shitty. So that was like right when I got bumped up to 60 milligrams of steroids. So then I started feeling well, like probably 2-3 weeks into the specific carbohydrate diet. I started tapering my steroids. Then like 2-3 months into the diet, as my steroids taper, I just get really shitty again. And I continue the diet. I go back to the chicken broth week, as they say you should. You know, I mean, we followed it to a T. If I did it today, if all I had tonight was chicken broth and boiled chicken, I would probably go 6 times tomorrow instead of 8,
mm-hmm.
but I'm going to have sushi,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I'm going to go 8. I mean, you know, so it's I don't know. I mean, and that actually the theory behind that diet made the most sense to me, which was probably what gave me the most motivation to try it. Cause mm-hmm. I really believe that I'm this dysbiosis. I'm in this, you know, biofilm dysbiotic state that's
sure.
I just can't get out of for some reason.
And you had also gotten a good response from antibiotics too, Cipro initially.
Yeah, I got really sick. We were going to Spain. My wife's from Spain, and I got really sick, like a really bad sore throat. I thought I had an abscess in my tonsil, and I had some Cipro at home, so I took it, and I got really well. I took it for like 21, and I just kept taking it. So I wrote myself another prescription. I took it for like 21 days. And I also started like a weird probiotic at that time. So I was just like, what do I do? I didn't want to touch anything. So they were like these Spanish probiotics I was shipping to the U.S. And but then it just kind of slowly, indolently came back.
Mm-hmm.
Just like everybody told me it would.
Yeah.
When I told them that the antibiotics helped, you kind of get like this spurt of feeling well, and then I don't know, they just win the you know, for whatever reason.
So you, just going back to the diet, so you did do it like to the absolutely to the letter of the book. You did the starter diet.
Oh,
you did the foods and stages.
Oh, yeah.
You really did it the way the book told you to do it, and it just
I did it like less than the book. I mean, I mean less aggressive than the book.
Mm-hmm. Like slower transition.
Yeah, because I was just like anal about it, you know.
Right.
I was like, well, you know, it says I can add apples. And I was like, apples, man, I don't know. It's not that fiber, you know.
Right.
So I would eat like, you know, I'd add a little bit. And we would keep a diary, and anything new, I would put a star on it. And then, like, bananas, it loves bananas, but I swear they made me worse.
Mm-hmm.
That was, like, one of the first things I think they let you add. It was, like, ripe bananas. Or not ripe, but, you know, aged bananas.
With spots and, on them, right.
Yeah, like the darkened bananas. And I felt like it made me worse, so then I stopped that. I still, again, I still use it, the diet, because I make the brownies. I eat a lot of almond butter. I don't know. I'm just a little bit, like, nostalgic about it. I drink a lot of apple cider. That's, like, my cheat through the day. Because recently, since I've like, signed up for surgery, I've been more liberal.
Sure.
Like, I had a burger today because I'm just like, fuck it.
Right.
You know, colon's coming out, man.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the fucking point? So, but I still was kind of, you know, pretty, even after I decided that the diet didn't work for me, I thought maybe it was just like, you know, I needed a more specific to me diet, not just that. So then I kind of came out of it slowly to try to like try different, you know, so.
Sure.
But no, I mean, it didn't work. I mean.
Yeah, and you had a scope after you had been on the diet for a while, and there were that's the main test, because
and that's what killed me, man. Like,
yeah, there was no difference.
I was hopeful, like, because everybody says the symptoms don't always correlate to
right. The
scopes, man. The scopes always killed me.
Yeah,
because like it was always at the after 12 weeks of Entyvio or 12 weeks of Remicade, you know, I had been on the diet for 5 months, and then they just give you like the worst results ever, and you're just like, you know, even though you kind of know. You just hope that they're like, well, look, they're pretty decent in there, actually. You know, but no. It was always like, how are you living?
So when is the surgery? You have it scheduled. It's soon, right?
Yeah, it's next week or the week after.
And what is the surgery they're going to do?
So I met with three surgeons. They gave me a couple options, and two of them, one route, and the third one, a different route. So you can obviously do a total colectomy, a total proctocolectomy with a permanent ileostomy, which is like, you know, sew your butthole closed, take your colon out. If you have an ileostomy, you're done, meaning that you don't have any other options in the future. Like you can't do a J-pouch, but you don't have any other surgeries in the future either planned. I mean, you can always have, if it turns out to be Crohn's or something like that, you can have complications, but you should be done. That was the only one surgeon gave me that option. The other two, granted, I was more sick when I saw the other two. Like, I walked in the door and they probably were like, whoa, this guy, man, needs help. They said they would prefer to stage it, do a colectomy, leave the rectum, like they leave 10, 15 centimeters of the rectum. Let me get well, or at least more well, taper off my steroids. And you have an ileostomy at that time. And then either the next stage would be do the J pouch or, you know, completion proctectomy, depending on how I felt, like 6 months to a year thereafter or longer. I guess there are people who live with that little stump of a rectum. You just have to surveil it for cancer. I was leaning towards the former, actually. I was like, you know, if I do this, you know, you've heard of the complications people can have with a J pouch. And then they threw in this Crohn's diagnosis at the end to me.
Right.
So I was a little bit like, whoa, you know, that whether it's there or not, like, I don't know about that. So I really still don't foresee myself doing a J pouch. So I was leaning towards the total proctocolectomy, you know, sewing my butthole closed. Like, this is serious. Not that the other isn't serious, but then just talking to my wife and my family and the surgeon, you know, they said that's a big decision to make. One, I'm not healthy, so my hemoglobin's 8. I told you my albumin's 2, which are both very low. I'm weak, you know, I have to sit down. So it's a bigger surgery, obviously. So there's that issue with doing the big all-in-one thing in the beginning. And then the recovery. The recovery from just the colectomy, leaving the rectal stump, it's laparoscopic, you know, hopefully, barring any complications. Is not that it's not bad, but it's much easier than the proctocolectomy. I mean, you know, they're saying you can't really walk well for at least a month. You know, you have issues, there can be wound healing stuff with that closure. So I'm doing the colectomy with the possibility of a J pouch, I guess.
Okay.
But, yeah. Which I doubt that I get. I would imagine. And really for me, it came down to the finality of having an ostomy forever.
Mm-hmm.
If you do if they sew you closed, you mean you're not getting. So in this way, I mean, actually, maybe you can answer this, Samir. I don't know. I haven't asked you yet.
Mm-hmm.
Can they give me 100% diagnosis after they take my colon out?
Usually, with the colectomy specimen, obviously they're looking for inflammation involving all layers of the bowel, transmural inflammation. Obviously, if they see granulomas, but they usually don't. But if they see transmural inflammation, then
it's Crohn's.
They call it Crohn's. But I've seen, just in my experience so far, that sometimes they still don't call it. They still don't. But I think if the pathologist has the information at the time and you really push them, you really need to call it one way or the other, then they usually should have enough information to do it.
Which, by the way, I've had, I don't know, 4 or 5, you know, flex sigs and colonoscopies over 3 years. They've always called it ulcerative colitis.
Yeah.
They've never said, you know, inflammation indeterminate. They've always said consistent with ulcerative colitis, you know, like.
The thing is that pathologist, and I'm pretty sure the pathologist who read your slides at Rush is a very good guy.
Yeah, you've
His
said
name
that.
Is Dr. Jakate, and he is, I just know from experience that he is very good at calling it one way or the other, just based on the look of it. He is very well trained, but you know it's nothing's ever 100%. Now, if you're having a colectomy and if they're calling this Crohn's colitis, that doesn't rule out the possibility of having a J pouch. Obviously, there's the risk of a Crohn's recurrence in the pouch, but they still do the surgery if there's no small bowel involvement and there's no significant perianal disease, which you had skin tags, which, you know, it's kind of a gray area, but you at least don't have like fistulas or like abscesses, perianal abscesses, which that would definitely be a reason not to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I don't know. I mean, you just don't know how you're going to deal with the ostomy, you know?
Yeah.
If everybody says I'm going to love it and be happy because I'm going to feel so much better, but you know, I don't feel like that right now. Obviously. Right.
I mean, the overall most people do well with J pouches, but you know, 50% get pouchitis or inflammation.
50%, but shit, that's not most, you know, that's a lot.
But the thing is, like, it's not the 50%, some of those people will just have it once and you treat it with antibiotics and it doesn't, maybe it'll come back a couple more times. Those people who have like chronic pouchitis or refractory pouchitis and require like long-term antibiotics, those people are rare. You know, it's the 50% includes all those people.
And this is stuff I need to think about, you know, and research. And, you know, I'm too sick right now. I have to do something, whether it be admitted and get, excuse me, whether it be admitted and do cyclosporin. Mm-hmm. For a week or have surgery. I mean, you know, and so, that's the surgeon said, he's like, I agree with you that making that decision for the proctocolectomy at this stage and how you're feeling and how you look is too much, probably.
Okay.
Like just too much, you know, you don't want to regret it because there's nothing you can come back on. Whereas the other one, I can kind of come back on in a way because I can do the J pouch.
Right.
you know, after living with an ostomy for a year, I can say, this is the worst thing ever. I hate my life. I'd rather risk pouchitis.
Sure, sure.
You know,
sure.
So.
That's true.
So that's kind of my thought, you know. I mean, I'm sitting here right now. I have a target on my belly. They already marked me where my – you go meet the ostomy nurse. Mm-hmm. They try on a bag. They look at you like your skin folds to see where it sits the best, and mm-hmm. they mark you. So
we'll see. I want to do a follow-up with you after the surgery, probably not immediately, but maybe like a few weeks to a month out from it.
Yeah.
And we'll just, you know, see what you thought, because, I mean, you really have been going through hell for the last 3 years. You've been on steroids pretty much the whole time.
Yeah.
And I'm really hopeful that you're going to feel a lot better. And this, the lesson learned from your case is that sometimes, no matter what you try, it just doesn't work. This disease can be very tenacious.
Yeah.
And I think it's important people realize from your story that, you know, not everybody's going to respond to the specific carbohydrate diet. I believe in the diet. I think it does work in some people.
You know what? I still do. I think I went back on it a few times. We've done the intro diet a few times. Mm-hmm. I just think whether I got too bad or my disease is too bad. Mm-hmm. I mean, whether if I had done the specific carbohydrate diet, you know, back in July of 2015, mm-hmm. maybe I had a chance. But right now it's just my disease or whatever is too powerful. You know what I mean?
Right.
That just that alone is so, you know, I feel like that's the in me because it just makes sense. And maybe not exactly the specific carbohydrate diet, but just like the idea of it and the kind of manipulating the bacteria with diet. And it should be really more like specific carbohydrate diet. Probably in the future they'll genetically test people and say, oh, you can have this and this, and the other guy can have this and this, you know.
It's a very complicated thing, but maybe based on your microbiome they could make a specific diet for you, but
something like that.
I know you have to go. If you could just kind of reiterate, summarize for the people who are struggling with this disease right now, who maybe are just diagnosed or just, you know, seeking information on how to manage this. And I know we talked about this before. What did you wish you did? And I know we talked about this. You wished you would have done things closer to their diagnosis as opposed to waiting, right?
Yeah, I feel like I underestimated the disease for a couple reasons. Number one, it's so indolent, like it just kind of sneaks up on you, man. Like all of us say, oh yeah, go in the bathroom 2-3 times. Okay, 4 or 5. Oh, I went like 10 times today. Oh, it's kind of weird, you know? Yeah. Oh man, I'm really feeling weak and tired. And then all of a sudden you're just like, shit, holy, I went to the bathroom 15 times today. I can barely walk up the stairs. Like, how did I get like this? Mm-hmm. So I think, when I was getting diagnosed, I was trying little things. Like, I remember I was calling you, oh, should I try turmeric, Samir? And you're like, yeah, you can. It's not going to hurt. And I was trying all these little things, trying to stay off meds, trying to stay off steroids, just like everybody. Nobody wants to take any of these meds. If you read the insert, you can't sleep. Even steroids, you think about the complications of those and you freak out.
Yeah.
So I would try to – my recommendation, and I have a friend who was recently diagnosed with Crohn's, was – to try to tackle it hard from the beginning and not to underestimate it. Mm-hmm. I almost hope that wasn't a mistake I made, you know, because that would suck if I could have gotten this under control and I made a mistake, but whatever, it is what it is. So I feel like that, and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but the research supports that your best chance is to kind of in the beginning.
I totally agree with that. The longer you wait as this smolders along and it's not definitively controlled from the outset, the harder it is to control later on. And what we use to control disease varies from patient to patient. You know, is it the mesalamine medications? Is it the biologics? Is it diet? Is it a combination of things?
Mm-hmm.
And as far as what you use to manage it, but just whatever you're going to do, don't just waste your time on steroids.
Yep.
That's the worst thing you can do. Steroids have the worst side effect profile of any, even the biologic medications, azathioprine.
You're pretty much guaranteed a side effect. I mean, it's not even, they shouldn't even be called side effects. They're just part of the drug. I mean, my wife and I have gotten in so many, you know, arguments, and I'm like, babe, it's like I'm on drugs. I mean, I'm literally on drugs. I mean, it literally makes me feel crazy.
And eventually what happens,
and it does, I mean,
and we talked about this, steroids, when you're on them, you know, after 1 month, 2 months, as you're on it on for several months, the steroids can become worse than the disease, the side effects from the steroids. They could,
this most recent flare, I think it did when I was at like the peak dose of steroids.
Yeah. And people get lulled into a false sense of security just because there's not that risk of lymphoma or cancer with the steroids. You're like, oh, osteoporosis doesn't sound so bad. Depression, anxiety, adrenal insufficiency. But these things are certainties. If you're on these medications for several months, you're going to get these things. And sometimes they can be irreversible. When the risks of lymphoma from azathioprine or infections from biologics like Remicade, those are there, but they're rare. Most people don't get them. Yeah. So people get into issue. They make a mistake by mischaracterizing the risks of these medications.
I agree 100%.
Yeah.
And again, as a physician, you would think I wouldn't. I think I probably magnified the in the wrong direction. You know what I mean? Me reading up, doing research, reading articles. I mean, I probably made it worse in my head than the layperson.
Yeah.
But yeah, my biggest advice is tackle it quick. Don't underestimate it. Don't, and I don't want to scare people. I mean, I am the minority, not by a huge amount, but I am the minority of people who don't respond to anything. And then get help kind of sooner than later, would be another one. I didn't really tell anybody. I still haven't told most people that I have this. You know, I think it's the more kind of people you have that know and can help you, the better, even just talking about it. But, you know, see your doctors, do everything on time, and I don't know, good luck. Okay, for one more thing, you know, for me, the decision I had mentioned earlier that I never really thought I would have surgery. I mean, I'd said it to all the surgeons I met. I was like, I can't believe I'm in your office. And I'm a surgeon, so I don't know if that is part of my resistance or what. I mean, everybody has resistance to have surgery. I feel like I probably had more than most. I had to, and my wife appreciated this also. My wife wanted me to have surgery like a year ago because she was like sad watching me, you know, walk to the car and, you know, slowly and, you know, but I had to feel like I did everything.
Right.
Oh, you know, I had to feel like I tried fecal transplant, which, by the way, I forgot to mention. I did do fecal transplants with one of my baby's poops for like 2 weeks.
Oh my
didn't work. It didn't work.
Okay.
But
that's good for people to know because that's a really hot topic. Obviously you're not doing it the way that it's being done in clinical trials, but you really went outside the box here.
To be honest, that was something and it is still something I want to try. We have all the supplies here. My wife and I were going to do it, but right now those damn skin tags are so ulcerated. I can't get myself an enema. Okay. I would pass out. It's so painful. So other than that, you know, I wanted to make sure I had tried everything, man. And that's Xeljanz was like my final straw. I said, if I get to do this and I had to have the insurance company agree because it's $7,000 a month, I almost paid for it. But so they gave me Xeljanz and that was kind of my final like, okay, now I've tried all these mechanisms of action. I've tried all these medications. It's time for me to, you know, throw in the towel.
And you were trying to enroll in clinical trials too. I remember talking to you about that.
Phil Gottlieb.
Right.
I think it's a specific JAK2 or something. Whereas, Xeljanz is like three different JAK kinase inhibitors.
Yeah. 1, 2, and 3 JAK inhibitors.
Yeah. So, I mean, in a way I felt like, well, Xeljanz is better.
Cause there was already data to show it worked.
Yeah. And it was more broad. I mean,
right.
The risks are more, but I thought maybe that means that the inflammation will go down better. Yeah.
Sure.
In my mind. So, but whatever, it didn't work, but I think that's something that people, I mean, you want control of this disease. You want to feel like you're dictating, and you want to feel like you're, that's why the diets are nice. And if it works, I mean, you know, that'd be the best thing ever, because then you're totally controlling it.
Right.
So you got to try a diet, because that's simple, cheap, healthy. I mean, it's like, it's a no brainer. Mm-hmm. So if that can do it, I mean, I think that's everybody's hope.
Right.
And if not that, then it's, you know, a medication, because you're taking it, you're doing it yourself, you know, and then now it's out of my hands.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately.
That's essentially what I came down to. So.
Okay, great. Thanks. Thanks so much for sharing your story. And we'll pick this up in about a month or so and see.
Yeah. Hopefully I'm 20 pounds heavier.
Yeah, hopefully you gain all the weight back, and I'm confident that you're going to feel, you know, back to yourself again. And I'm just sorry you've been suffering for these 3 years. But I think after the surgery, you're going to be good. You're going to be happy it was done.
That's the goal, man.
Yeah. All right.
All right, Samir.
Okay. Thanks. All right, brother. Thanks for your time. Hey. All right.